that you're here. So, who's getting ready to cook out this weekend? All right, you got a grill, you know, that's one thing, you know. I do breakfast and grill in our household, so that's kind of like a big deal. I'm going to get to grill, so I'm excited about that this weekend. Hey, I want to let you know, as the ushers are going to come forward, and they're going to take an offering as we do every week. And if you came prepared to give, to partner with what God is doing through our community, both locally and globally, if you came prepared to give financially and to worship God in that way, this would be the time to do that. And as they do, I want to let you know about next week is Kids Space. And so we're excited about that. And Kids Space is an event that we design for families. It's focused on elementary school age kids and preschool kids and their parents. And what we try to do is we try to create an environment where we can bring the family together, and it can serve as a launching point for conversations around certain virtues and values. And so next week is going to be on this virtue of courage. And so up here the stage will be completely different. You'll see that next week, and there'll be all sorts of dramas on Sunday afternoon, and you'll see, you know, all sorts of, you know, crazy music and skits, all sorts of things. Be a lot of fun in here, and we'll have a 45-minute program. But outside beforehand, we'll have all sorts of inflatables. We'll have, you know, rock climbing wall. We'll have ice cream so you can get your kids all sugared up and then try to get them in bed. And so it'd be a great time. That starts at 3:30. So it'll run from 3:30 Sunday afternoon till 6 o'clock. And it's free, so it's a great way for you to invite any of your friends and family, maybe wanting to expose them to Cross Point, but you're like, yeah, Sunday morning's a little much. And so it's going to be a great time, a lot of fun. So we encourage you to come, you and your families, come in here, hang out with us, play, have a good time. And that'll be next Sunday at 3:30. All right. Now, one of the quotes that have impacted me greatly, I kind of collect certain quotes, and sometimes I write them on cards and stick them either in front of me on my wall, or I'll stick them in a book that I'll be reading. But one of the quotes that have impacted me greatly through the years is from an author named A.W. Tozer. And he writes this. He writes, "What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us." Now think about that for a moment. What comes into our minds when we think about God, he says, is the most important thing about us. Now, when you let that sit with you for a while, you begin to realize, and you kind of begin to unpack it, that what comes into our minds when we think about God, regardless of how positive or negative, regardless of how accurate or inaccurate it is, has a huge impact on everything. It impacts the choices that we make, the way that we choose to live. It impacts our perspective on life. It impacts our attitudes, our behaviors. It impacts our relationships. And it also has a huge impact about what we think about when it comes to worship. We've been in a series of teachings the last couple of weeks called Live in Concert, also known as Live in Concert, where we've been exploring some of the mystical nature. Thinking about God in a certain way, and that God looked at him and his life and the way that he lived and the mistakes that he made in a certain way. And kind of the metaphor, the picture that he had in his mind when he thought about how God looked at his life was kind of this picture of him learning how to ride a bike, where he would be trying to ride this bike, but he would keep falling off and, you know, he'd keep messing up. And the picture that he had of God was God standing at a distance, kind of with his arms folded. And when he would fall, he would just shake his head in disappointment. That is, if we continue to fall and continue to mess up, God would continually get more and more frustrated at him and say, you know, what is wrong with you? Why can't you just stay on the bike? What is your problem? And that's what came into his mind when he thought of God and how God saw him. But then he went on to describe this kind of aha moment that he had a while back. Because now his kids were of an age where they were actually learning to ride their own bikes, and he would be out there with them, and they would be trying to ride the bike, and he would be coming alongside them, and they would fall down. And he would get them back up, and they would fall down again. And what he discovered was that his natural instinct as a father was to just simply pick them up, dust them off, and let them know that he was right there. And he would help them get back on the bike so that they could try again. And as he did that over and over and over again with his kids, something shifted in his thinking, and he began to realize, well, wait a second. I mean, that's how Jesus was. That we see Jesus, God in the flesh, all throughout the Scriptures. Jesus was always walking among people who had this habit of messing up their lives, falling off the bike over and over again. And yet Jesus, he never condemns them. He never shakes his head in disappointment and just kind of piles on the guilt. But rather, Jesus, we find, always picking them up, loving them, putting them back on the bike, and pointing them in the direction where real life could be found. And my friend described how this shift in thinking really began to change everything about how he saw God and how he related to God and how he saw God saw him. See, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. Now, there's lots of different arenas that we could explore this morning in our thinking about God, but there's one in particular that I want to kind of focus on and drill down on, because I think it's one that keeps many people, and maybe many of you here in this room, at a distance from God. Sometimes just enough distance to make it feel like something's slightly off. It's not this big chasm between you and God, but something where it's just like, you know, man, it's just off a little bit. I just can't get too close. But for others, it may be a huge chasm between you and God. It may be this huge point of contention of why you've never stepped into faith and trust and surrender to Jesus. And over again, I keep hearing this reason that people give for why they won't even consider God and the possibility of trusting and surrendering their lives over to Him. And so I want to dive down on this one very specific aspect of the way that we tend and can think about God. If you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to the book of Exodus, chapter 20. Exodus is in the Old Testament. It's the second book of the Bible. If you don't have a Bible, then one, we'd love to give you one. You can pick one up in our information center. Or two, you can follow along on the screen. The words will be behind me on there. But in Exodus chapter 20, we find this account of an event that many of us are familiar with, regardless of how much of Bible we knew growing up, maybe, or how much of we were involved in church. Many of us are kind of aware of it. And it's at this point in history that we find in Exodus chapter 20, where God has raised up a man named Moses to help lead God's people, the Israelites, out from under the oppression of slavery to Pharaoh, who was in Egypt. And so the sea splits, and the people and the Israelites walk across on dry land, and Charlton Heston, who looked a lot like Moses, begins leading the Israelites toward a land of their own that God had promised them. And so along the way, God tells Moses to meet him at the top of a mountain, and God gives Moses these 10 commandments that he, in turn, was to share with the people of Israel. And the intent of these commands was to teach the Israelites how to best live life, how to enjoy life the way it was created and designed and meant to be. And so this is what God says, starting in Exodus chapter 20, verse 2. God says, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." Now, sometimes when people read the Ten Commandments, or sometimes when we see them posted on a wall, this first verse often gets left out. But this first thing that God says is critical for us understanding the context in which these commandments are spoken. Because, you see, God is setting the stage with what he's about to say with this context of, remember that I am your God. Remember that I love you. Remember, I'm the one who has showed himself faithful over and over and over again. I'm the one who rescued you out of your slavery so that you can be free. You can trust me. My intent, understand, is what it always has been, and that is to lead you into life. And then he goes into the Ten Commandments. Now, what follows are not commands that are intended to stifle people's living or rules to try to keep people under God's thumb somehow, but rather God is teaching and instructing his people through these commandments how best to live life. And that's an important distinction to make. I mean, we talk about that a lot, but we need to remember that, you know, when it comes to the Ten Commandments, God is saying, listen, life is going to be much better for you. The world is going to be much better if you don't sleep with other people's spouses. Life will be much better. The world will be much better if you don't murder each other, if you don't take things that belong to someone else. Life is going to be much better for you. You will enjoy life much more if you learn to be content with what you have rather than always lusting after what someone else has. Life is going to work best for you if you learn to rest regularly and consistently
so that you don't get caught up in thinking that what you do and what you produce determines your worth and value in this world. God keeps giving these commands to his people because they're in the best interest of their lives. His desire is to lead people into life. And I don't know anybody who would say, you know what, as I really look at those, God's really kind of got it wrong on that one. You know, the world would be a lot better if everybody just slept with other people's spouses. You know, I would enjoy life a lot more that way. So would everybody. There'd be no tension, no awkwardness. Everybody'd get along. That'd be great. You know, the world would be a lot better if everybody murdered each other, you know, and you just got tired of somebody, murder them, and then everybody's happy, you know, everybody's good, their loved ones are good, you're good, world would be a lot better place. I mean, nobody's going to say, you know what, God's kind of got it wrong with that one. So it's with that context of what God's intent is in giving us these Ten Commandments and who God is and his love for us that we should also understand the first commands that God gives. Listen to verse 3. It says, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. Verse 5, you shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I am the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Now, here's where thinking about God and how people think about who God is can go sideways, even subtly at times. Maybe you found yourself struggling, maybe somewhere a point along in your journey. Maybe you're at this point now where you've had this disconnect with God and you've never been quite able to put your finger on it. You've never been able to know, there's something that just kind of keeps God at a distance from me, and there's a reason I just can't fully engage or get serious about getting close to God. And whenever I think about getting really close to God, there's just this sense of kind of like, and I just want to keep him at a distance. Perhaps one of the reasons may be that when you see scriptures where God says, worship me, don't have any other gods before me, don't make any idols, don't worship anything else besides me. Perhaps what subtly goes on in your thinking is you can start to begin to think about God as having this insatiable need for us to tell him how great he is. For some of us, what starts to happen is we can start to think that God is somehow obsessively caught up with himself and he needs his ego stroked constantly. And when that becomes one of the filters through which we think about God, something instinctively in us, just reflex-wise, it just goes, nah. And we just kind of push God away. Because after all, we all know people that are like that. Don't we? I mean, people that are way into themselves, people that are always trying to bait you for compliments, where their own ego demands that everything be about them and they want to make sure everyone notices them. These are the kind of people that none of us really like to be around all that much, do we? And even if we are around them, if we have to be around them, we can only take so much of them before we just kind of have to push them out to a distance. We start to avoid them a little bit. Because we just get turned off by this, it's all about me, this worship me kind of attitude. So when that becomes the lens through which we also think about God, there's something in us that without even realizing it, for some of us, makes us kind of go, eh, and just keeps God at a distance. For others of us, though, it's not subtle at all. I mean, I've had people describe the God of the Bible, and they refer to him as an egocentric maniac. And when they describe God that way, they point to verses exactly like this, in this very characteristic of God, as the reason why they would never trust the God of the Bible, even if he did exist. Even if he did exist, they wouldn't trust him because he's an egocentric maniac in their minds. You see, it's true. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. And it ripples out into every aspect of our lives. And so in order for us to pursue God, we find ourselves not only needing to think rightly about who God is, but we also have to think rightly about what it means to worship him and what God means when he says to worship himself. One of my favorite authors is a guy by the name of Dallas Willard. Brilliant, brilliant author. And he's a professor of philosophy at the University of Southern California. He defines worship this way. He says, worship is the intentional turning of the mind to God and ascribing to God all of the greatness and goodness and glory that belongs to Him. I like that. Worship is this intentional turning of the mind to God. Now, with that understanding, here's this paradigm. Here's this filter, this way of thinking that all of us have to get in order for this huge idea to begin to sink in. So this is key. This is foundational, all right? Worshiping God is ultimately about our need, not God's need. We've got to get that. And for some of us, that sounds off. It sounds wrong. It sounds unfamiliar. Some of us, it's like, okay, that makes sense, but it's foundational. Worshiping God is ultimately about our need, not God's need. You see, all of us have a desperate need to worship the right thing. Because all of us worship something. I mean, all of us orient the majority of our thinking around someone or something. All of us have someone or something that we give credit or glory to as the source of what we believe brings us the most joy and happiness. And so it's what we run after. It's what we orient ourselves around. It's what we orient our thinking around, that we intentionally turn our thinking around this thing. For some of us, it becomes success. We get consumed with the next position up on the corporate ladder. We get consumed with the next title. We get consumed with the next pay raise. And what we do is we become convinced that that's where this elusive happiness or contentment or sense of value will come from. And so you orient your entire life around achieving that status or success. For others of us, it's wealth. For others of us, it becomes retirement, where everything gets oriented around that goal. All of our thinking, all of our goals, all of our plans, all of our choices get oriented around retirement, because that's where peace and joy and happiness is going to be found. For some of us, it's another person. Maybe it's a spouse, maybe it's a child, maybe it's a boyfriend or a girlfriend. And somehow we get caught up in this expectation that this other person is supposed to somehow meet all of our needs, that all of our needs are supposed to be met in this one person. And so we end up giving them all the credit, or we also end up giving them all the blame for whether or not we have joy in our life, for whether or not we're happy, for whether or not we're content, for whether or not we have peace. It's all determined by them. It's worship. It's worship. Now, you may never have thought about it that way, but that's what it is. Where we find ourselves setting someone or something else up as an idol, and we determine that's where goodness is found, and we orient our thinking and our thoughts obsessively around that. But you see, here's what God knows about us. God knows that if we want to be free, if we want to enjoy life the way it's created to be, the only way that that happens is to orient our life around Him and His ways. And when we substitute God for anything else, whether that be money, whether that be success, whether that be other people, it becomes an idol. And God knows that it will lead us away from freedom. It will lead us into slavery. It leads us away from contentment. It leads us away from peace. It leads us away from the very life that all of us yearn and long to live for. That's why Jesus in John 10:10, God in the flesh, comes to earth and He says, "I have come that they," that you and I, "may have life." He doesn't say, "I have come because I have this insatiable need for humans to tell me how great I am." But, "I have come that they," that you and I, "may have life." So that when people orient their lives around me and my ways, they will be led into life. We say this a lot around here. We try to emphasize it, that every command that God gives, every command that God gives in the Scriptures is for the purpose of ushering His people into life. And that includes the command of worship the Lord your God and serve Him only. It's not because God is an egocentric maniac. What's at stake ultimately is not God's need, it's our need. Because God knew then, and He knows now, that any type of idol that replaces God as the object of our worship leads toward bondage and devastation. And so in Exodus chapter 20, sometimes people get hung up on the Ten Commandments because of this statement that God says at the end where he describes himself as a jealous God. He says, "For I am a jealous God." But the Hebrew word that's translated as jealous there, it's only used in reference to God in the Scriptures. And it's a different word and distinct from the type of negative jealousy that humans can wrestle with and that we can get caught up in and that leads to all sorts of problems. But when used with God, the word jealousy is an adjective that's rooted in this idea of expressing God's desire for simply exclusive loyalty. I mean, we see God warn his people all throughout the Scriptures. He says, don't flirt with other gods, don't flirt with other idols that are just made by human hands and made of stone and wood. Don't toy with them. He commands his children, stay exclusively loyal and committed to me. Remember, I'm your God. I love you. I rescued you from slavery. You can trust me. I have your best interest in mind. These other idols, they don't. They're not real. Yet throughout the Scriptures, we see this recurring story of God's people becoming distracted. God's people turning their thinking away and experimenting with other idols, false gods like Molech and Baal and Asherah. And over time, their thinking wandered so far that the Israelites we see in the Scriptures find themselves even putting their own children into furnaces, slashing themselves with swords, doing all sorts of destructive and terrible things in these effort to please these statues made of stone. And so God, out of his love for us, commanded his people then and commands his people now, commands us to not get distracted by idols that lead to destruction, but instead says, worship me. Intentionally turn your thoughts and orient your life around me. I will lead you into life. You can trust me. I love you. Later on in the New Testament, a follower of Jesus named Paul, he writes this in a letter to the Christians in Rome. He says in verse 2 of chapter 12, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That if you want to be transformed, it begins, the Scriptures say, with the changing of the way that we think. That we have to change the way we think. If we want our lives to be transformed, if we want to be led into life. And so with the moments that we have left, what I want to do is I want to share some thoughts with you on how this happens. And then Stephen's going to come out and he's going to lead us through some time together. But I want to share a couple thoughts on how this thinking can change, specifically in the context of when we gather together as a community. How do we go about intentionally turning our minds to God and letting God begin to transform our thinking? Because it so much hinges on that. Now, most of us understand this principle that what we think about most affects our behavior. We kind of all tend to understand that. There's been lots of studies on that. It's, you know, been published many times, all sorts of articles on the news. And it just makes sense that what we choose to put into our minds are that our thoughts and the words and the images that we choose to dwell on or meditate on has an effect on our behavior. That just makes sense. But often what I find is that we resist another principle and don't give credence to another principle that's just as true. And that is that what I do or my actions, my behavior actually affects how I think. That my behavior affects how I think. And that if you want to change the way that you think, if you want to change the way that you feel about someone, if you want to change the way that you think about someone or something, then one of the steps that you need to take is to begin behaving, to begin taking actions that model how it is that you want to feel and that model how it is that you want to think. Now, when I sit down with people, maybe in a counseling kind of scenario, or maybe just, you know, over coffee or over lunch, and, you know, I maybe listen to somebody's story and they kind of, you know, share with me something that's going on, and I kind of present this idea that you need to behave your way into thinking a certain way, very often there's a common pushback. And that idea is, well, wait a second. You know, I don't want to be a hypocrite. You know, I'm not going to be a hypocrite. So if I don't feel something, if I don't think something, then I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to pretend. So I'm not going to be a hypocrite. And so we see that playing itself out in so many different ways in our lives where people will say, well, you know what, if I don't feel loving toward my spouse, then I'm not going to serve them. If I don't feel romantic toward them, then, you know, I'm not going to express love to them. You know, we say, well, if I don't feel any type of fondness for this coworker of mine, if I don't have feelings that, you know, that I actually like them, then I'm not going to treat them nicely. I'm not going to be kind to them. I'm not just going to put on a front. I'm not going to pretend. You know, if I don't feel like forgiving this person yet, if I don't feel like forgiving them, if my heart hasn't changed, if my feelings haven't changed, if my thoughts haven't changed, then you know what? I'm just going to continue to give them the cold shoulder. You know, I'm not going to treat them kindly, you know, because I don't feel that way. That would be wrong. If I don't feel generous, you know, towards something, then I'm not going to give. You know, I'm only going to do it if I feel like, you know, I want to be generous toward that. And if I don't feel it, then I'm not going to do it. If I don't feel close to God, people say, hear this a lot. You know, if I don't feel close to God, if I don't feel right with God, if I don't feel like I've done enough right things, or if I don't feel like I'm holy enough, or, you know, then I'm not going to go inside that church. I mean, if I do, then I'm not really going to try to get to know anybody, or I'm not going to try to participate in anything because I just don't feel like it yet. And to not feel like it and do it, then that would just be wrong. And the reason I hear over and over again, people say, you know, I just don't want to feel like a hypocrite. You know, perhaps one of the reasons, maybe the only reason, that you showed up here this morning is to hear this very important principle for life. That if you want to be a loving person, if you want to be a generous person, if you want to be a person that offers grace, whatever kind of person that you want to be and the qualities that you want to see in your life, stop waiting around for a feeling. Stop waiting for a feeling and then do something. Stop waiting around for your thinking to change before you actually do something. Do it. And then do it again. Behave the way that you want to think. And let your behavior start to direct your thoughts. Now, we could spend a whole hour on that because there's so many layers to that and there's so many implications of that, both negatively and positively, of about how that affects our life and the way that we think. But what I want us to get specifically for today is how much that affects worship. Because you see, so many times we need to do something. We need to take some sort of action to help intentionally turn our thoughts toward God and toward who He is. I was talking with a friend just the other day who's been going through a pretty difficult season, and she was describing about how she was making it through. And she said, you know, every single morning I just take my hands and I kind of just turn it over to God, because I know every morning when I wake up that, you know, what is facing me is just way too big. And if I try to dwell on that, if I try to take it on myself, if I try to think about everything that's going on, it's just going to overwhelm me and consume me. And so as she was sharing, I stopped her and I asked, okay, now, wait a second. Were you talking figuratively or were you talking literally when you say, I just turn my hands over and give it to God? And she said, yeah, no, it's very literal for me. Every single morning, I physically take my hands and I turn it over to God and I say, God, you've got to take this. Because if you don't, this is just going to overwhelm me and crush me. And so every morning, I turn my hands over and I hand it over to God. And you see, it's this posture, it's this simple action, it's this simple behavior that's helping her on a daily basis direct her thoughts toward who God is and what God desires. And you see, postures, all types, are very helpful in intentionally directing our thoughts toward God. But many times, especially in the context of a worship gathering or a service like this on a Sunday morning, many times they get misunderstood. For instance, you'll see people in a worship gathering just like this, and singing will be going on, and some people raise their hands. And so all of a sudden, there's unfortunately become this sense of, well, you know, it becomes this type of spiritual barometer, this posture that some people will take. Well, that kind of determines how close you are with God or how much you feel the Spirit. And so we would look at somebody who maybe raises their hands while they're singing, and other people that don't say, well, man, I just don't feel that close to God. I've never felt like raising my hands. And so maybe I don't love God as much as they do. And so they start to judge themselves. Maybe I don't have enough of the Spirit. I wonder why I don't feel that, or I've never felt that. So they start to judge themselves. But then if they don't judge themselves, sometimes they go in the opposite direction and they start to judge them. The people that are raising their hands are like, well, look at them trying to draw all sorts of attention to themselves. You know, they're trying to make it all about them. They're trying to show off. They're trying to do that. They want everyone to notice them. But see, the thing also happens for the people that raise their hands. Because sometimes what they can get, and they can get in this mindset, if they raise their hands while they're singing, and they're looking around at other people that don't raise their hands, and they're just like, don't these people love Jesus? You know? I mean, don't these people love God? I mean, does anyone else not recognize how great and awesome our God is? And so we look around and we judge people. And so it becomes this spiritual barometer that people try to determine about how close someone is to God or how much they love God. And it's amazing the different conversations that go on in our heads and all the judging that takes place. And in doing that and all the judging, we miss the simple reality that it's simply a posture. It's simply one way that people can use to help direct their thoughts toward God. You know, often I sing and I sit down here in the front row in this service with my wife, and there's times when we're singing where I raise my hands. And the reason I do at times isn't because I necessarily feel something. Just want to let you know. It's just because for me, it's this helpful way of directing my thoughts toward God. It's a posture that I take because, you know, I think about my little kids and, you know, my little guy Trace, especially now that he's almost 4, and he'll still run up to me and he just lifts his hands up to me. And he's like, Daddy, I just want you to pick me up. And there's times when I need to put myself in a posture that's like, God, I just need you to hold me. And so I'm just going to direct my thoughts that way by my posture. There's times when I just need to, you know, I'm looking around, I get distracted by other things, and I just need to direct my thoughts upward toward God. Not that God's up there somewhere, but it just helps me think about God and who He is. So I lift my hands or I open them up and just say, God, I got to give this up to you. I just got to surrender. But there's also times that I sit there and I stand there with my hands down to my side, and it's easier for God to direct my thoughts that way. It's no less spiritual or closer to God whether you direct your thoughts that way or if you raise your hands. But we've got to find intentional ways to direct our thoughts toward God. There's sometimes when we're sitting in service where other people might be standing, and I just sit. And I just bow my head and close my eyes because other things are distracting me. And so for me, that's the best posture for me to direct my thoughts toward God. And I do that because that's the most helpful for me in that moment. There's sometimes when I clap. Sometimes I don't clap. Sometimes I do. Because there's sometimes when I do it when I don't feel like it. And I hear that, well, I just don't feel like it, so I'm not clapping. Sometimes the very reason when I don't feel like it is the reason I do, because I need to remind myself. I need to put my posture in such a way and take action in such a way that reminds me of how great our God is. That the God that I'm worshiping, the God that I'm celebrating, is the very God that's giving me the breath that I have to breathe right now at this moment. And so even though I might not feel very joyful and I might not feel very grateful, I need to do something in my action that reminds me and directs my thoughts towards celebrating how good and great God is. Doesn't mean, well, if you clap all the time, then you're super spiritual. If you don't, you really don't really love God or into the music. It's just something you can do. There's times in my house, there's times in my office that I have to fall down on my knees and pray. I don't get down on my knees all the time when I pray. Sometimes I'm just sitting on the couch, you know, and I'll close my eyes. Sometimes I'm in my car. Don't close my eyes when I'm in the car, but I want you to know that. So talk out loud with my eyes open. You can do that as well. You know, imagine that. You know, you can pray and actually have your eyes open. And sometimes that's a very freeing reality to try. Closing your eyes, it's a posture that you can do to help direct your thoughts toward God. But there's sometimes I just fall down because I need to be reminded of how huge and great God is. And that I need to depend on Him. Sometimes I get so caught up in my own pride and that I can handle all this on my own. And I need to put my body in a position that humbles me and creates a sense of dependence on me. And in me and my being toward God. And so whatever you do, we just need to be intentional about turning our mind toward God. And we use postures, we use behaviors to help us do that. And it's one of the same reasons that we gather together in this room week after week. that we're intentional about gathering together week after week because we're committed to living in concert with God. We become committed to saying, I need time every single week that I turn our minds toward Him and the life that He invites me into, where I take time to ascribe to God all the goodness and greatness and glory that He deserves. And while we can do that every single day, and we can do that with the lives that we live, as Stephen reminded us a couple weeks ago, we also do it communally once a week together because we're committed to also living in concert with one another. Where there's times where I'll walk in here on a Sunday morning and I don't necessarily feel God's great, and I might not feel that God loves me or that God's proud of me. I might have that sense of God just kind of shaking His head in disappointment to me, and me coming here and listening to you sing, you being here, and me hearing your stories about how God has changed your life, and that all floods back into my mind, and I hear you sing or I hear Stephen sing about God's love. It reminds me of how great and awesome God is, and it reminds me of His faithfulness, and I need that. I need you to help me. We need each other, which is why we do this in concert with one another. And there's times when maybe you don't feel like it, but this is a discipline of coming and meeting together that you say, because I don't feel like God maybe loves me. I don't feel like God cares about me. I don't feel like God's even there. And you need to hear from someone else. You need to hear others sing. You need to be around other people who can encourage you and remind you and redirect your thoughts toward God. So I'm going to ask Stephen and the band to come out for a few moments. And they're just going to take some time, and they're just going to lead us in kind of a time of singing and a time of reflection, taking some time to read, and just however that we need to just kind of intentionally turn our thoughts back to God and so that He can launch us into the rest of today and the rest of the week and the rest of the month toward life. And we find ourselves reminded that we need to live not only in concert with God, but that in concert with one another, and that our worship of God is not primarily about God's need for His ego to get stroked, but He knows that it's about our need, and that we need to think rightly about God and who He is, to orient our lives around Him, and that when we do so, it leads us into the life that we were created to live, the very life that we all dream about and long to live. Let's pray. Father, thank You for this time that we can carve out on our calendars every single week to come and to sing and to gather and to encourage and to challenge and to put ourselves in a posture of being in this room among other people in an environment where we can have our thoughts redirected towards You. So, Father, would You do that for us in the next few moments? We pray in Jesus' name.
Splendor of a king, clothed in majesty, let all the earth rejoice, all the earth rejoice.